Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode is episode number 90. We're bringing on George Pereira. George works for the Miami-Dade Police Department. He's a major, a commander. He works in the major cyber crimes unit. And let me tell you, George has been there. Well, basically, George has been there forever, and he is outstanding. He has an understanding of what criminals do, why they do it, how they do it, how to catch them, how to put them in prison for a long time. He knows every single thing that someone on the good guy side of the fence that combats cyber criminals every single day should know. He is outstanding. He was kind enough to sit down with me on the Brett Johnson Show, and we basically shoot the shit for a while. And let me say, the opinions of George and what he talks about are strictly George's opinions. They are not those of the Miami-Dade Police Department. George was very adamant about that, so I wanted to mention that before we go into the show. Hey, if you guys don't mind, before we start, why don't you take a minute and press that little subscribe button that's there? I would appreciate it. I'm looking to build my subscriber base. So take a minute. If you like the show, subscribe. If you don't like the show, subscribe. Then bitch about it in the comment section, and we'll take it from there. Without further ado, I am absolutely thrilled, pleased, and humbled to have George Pereira on the Brett Johnson Show. Are you in my? Where are you? Miami?
I am in Miami.
So in Miami. You've heard my story, right, about Miami or not?
No.
Okay, so my dad. Mm-hmm. No better way to start the show than with this story, I guess. I was I'd been saying in my presentation that I was 10. Turns out I was 12. When my dad, he was watching a 60-minute segment. We were in Hazard, Kentucky. He was watching a 60-minute segment. The segment was talking about all the drug trafficking in Miami, and it was showing the pallets of cash, the tables of cocaine, all that stuff. So he's locked onto it. He gets through watching the 20-minute segment, looks over at my mom. I think I need to go down to Miami and be a cop. And my mom's like, I think you do. And the whole plan was for him to become a police officer, get down there, happen upon a drug deal, keep the cash. They'd let him. He'd keep the cash. They'd keep the drugs, and everybody be happy. And I kept thinking, hell, they're just going to shoot your ass is what they're going to do. So based on that, no kidding, George, based on that, they rounded up about $6,000 cash, sold what they could in the house, rented a U-Haul truck, and headed south on I-75. And we got there. Wow. There were some riots when we got there. That was 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Riots when we got there. And we ended up staying at a Days Inn that was right across from this bridge where all these homeless people were. So that was scaring my mom to death. My dad, he goes to cop school day one, comes back. I think it's going to work. A couple of days later, he comes in. We can't stay. And what had happened was the Miami-Dade cops had burst in, had arrested, five or six people that had outstanding warrants that evidently had the exact same idea that he had. So they load back up north on I-75. No idea where they were going to go until they both remembered that they had spent spring break in Panama City, Florida. And that's how we ended up in PCB right there. That's a true story right there, man. That's Brett Johnson's life right there.
That's crazy, bro.
Yeah, yeah. So George Pereira.
Pereira.
George Pereira. 25 years as a cybercrime investigator?
Well, I have 35 years with the department.
Okay.
I've been in technology in one facet or another for the department for probably close to 25 years.
Right.
And that's been multiple different stops along the way. Our IT section, our 911 center.
Right.
And then ultimately, I created now this capacity within the department for our cyber crimes.
Outstanding. Let me ask you this, and I want to go into some biography with you too, but how have you seen cybercrime change over that 25-year span?
Well, I mean, initially there was nothing, you know, there was no, I mean, there was, in the early days, when I say the early days, we're going back into the 90s for me. You know, you had a couple of clowns that were playing around, and they, you know, they were writing viruses and things, but that was more for fun and laughs. You know, it wasn't for, you know, for anything other than that. And that kind of spawned the antivirus industry, because, you know, people didn't want to be, I guess, they didn't want their computers or their networks to be compromised at someone's expense, you know, for fun.
Right.
Because that's impactful to their, you know, operations, et cetera. You know, that was the initial things. And then you had the beginnings of some e-commerce, you know, with, probably in the latter 90s is when you had that transition, and you started to see some people doing, you know, transactions online.
Right.
And I think that, you know, began, you began to see more criminal activity, because, you know, people saw the opportunity to be able to look at a new emerging area and take advantage of that. And clearly that's occurred. And it's been evolving. That whole thing has been a continuous evolutionary process,
right,
since then, as you well know.
Yeah, I have some knowledge of that. as you know. So people know how I got involved in this. Lord knows I've talked about it a lot. But how did you come upon a career trying to stop people like I used to be?
Well, like I outlined earlier, I had been in various facets of police technology, you know, from networking to, 911 telephony to, the gamut of everything we had, you know, supporting our mobile data terminals, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So I kind of got in that through more of a security type of a role, kind of overseeing that aspect of things, and that kind and learning about that, and that kind of kind of transitioned into this kind of a role.
Right.
My organization has always had some presence in cyber, but it was more like digital forensics and internet crimes against children, which is really, you know, the backbone of most law enforcement cyber that's out there for the most part. But, you know, I saw this stuff and, you know, that was kind of on the horizon, and, you know, we started discussing that internally with the big bosses, and talking about, you know, what trying to, you know, because they always try to position themselves to try to be on top of whatever the next threat is.
Right.
And, you know, a decision was made by the big bosses that we were going to, pursue this line. And they told me to figure that out and set it up. And that's kind of how I got into it.
Let me ask you on that. I was the criminal, and now that I've transitioned to, you know, the good guy side, one of the things that I have seen is that sometimes it takes some convincing to sway someone to enact proper security or to target a specific type of area of crime or fraud, things like that. Was that a situation when you were trying to explain to the higher ups that, hey, this is a problem that's coming, or not?
Well, first of all, I want to preface, you know, our entire conversation here by saying that, you know, these are the words and opinions of George Pereira.
Absolutely.
And not of the Miami-Dade Police Department. It was not for my boss, who's the director now. It wasn't a big convincing job for him. No, not at all. You know, he he was pretty up on technology. You know, we had had talks about different topics in crime and technology. You know, I currently and have in the past sat on multiple boards and committees throughout the United States at all different levels regarding, you know, technology, police technology and cybercrime.
Right.
So it was not a hard sell for my guys. Not at all, not my team here. They saw the line, you know, very, very clearly. So it was not difficult.
I appreciate that. I do. Cause I've seen agencies that were outstanding, and I've seen agencies that were just kind of overwhelmed. And I'm glad to see that you were, you know, in one that was on point, and hats off to Miami-Dade. I mean, they do a fantastic job with every single thing they do. They really do. I do want to talk about George a little bit.
Sure.
So where'd you grow up, in Miami or not?
No, sir. I, originally from Maine.
From Maine?
Maine. Yes, sir.
So you migrated south for the weather or what?
No, my dad got a job transfer down here.
Okay.
And so we moved down here when I was in ninth grade.
All right.
And finished high school here, went to the military, got out of the military, got hired by the department. Pretty
what
much
branch
the
rest of military did you go into?
I was in the Army.
How many years?
3 years, MP.
Much respect for the service. My dad was a captain in the Army, helicopter pilot.
Wow.
He got booted out. What? Well, not booted out. They downsized and they gave him the opportunity. They were like, hey, you can stay in, but we're going to boot you down to a staff sergeant, or you can get out. And at that point in time, the coal business was booming. So he was like, I'll go be a coal miner. And that just spiraled down from there. So
wow.
Now you, what'd you go to college for?
Well, I was working, you know, I decided that, you know, higher education was a good thing.
Yeah.
So I, you know, working full time, went to college part time, and I got, you know, my undergraduate degree, and then moved on to my first master's, which was in public administration. Sure. And I got a graduate certificate in emergency management. And then I got my second master's from the Naval Postgraduate School and security studies, where I focused on cybersecurity.
That's pretty damn impressive. Now, did you always want to go into some sort of law enforcement or public service or not?
I did. I was a scout, you know, Boy Scout, my, you know, up entire from when I was, you know, small, started in Cub Scouts and went through the whole thing and finished as an Eagle Scout and Boy Scouts. And then from there I transitioned into, Explorers, the Police Explorer program. And so I knew I wanted to be in law enforcement. But when I was in high school as a police explorer, I was like, you know, Miami-Dade was hiring you at 19, but I'm thinking myself, boy, that's young. I didn't know that. I thought I was a little bit young for working the streets in Miami at the time. Sure. So I opted to go in the military. I figured I'd go in the military, get the GI Bill, and also get some experience, you know, so I went in the military as an MP.
Nice. Nice. So military MP, what are you dealing with mostly there?
Well, that kind of stuff primarily is, a lot of silliness with soldiers. You know, they go out, you know, they get, you know, back then, you know, we were paid once a month.
Right.
So, when you were paid once a month, you know, a lot of guys, especially single guys, you know, get their whole paycheck, cash their whole paycheck, and then they go and raise some cane, you know. And so that was a lot of what we had to deal with. But we also had to deal with, you know, normal kind of stuff that you would as a cop, you know, domestic disputes, you know, those kinds of things. Not generally any, you know, serious types of crimes.
Okay. Do you enjoy that kind of work, being an MP or not?
Oh, yeah, it was fun. Yeah, okay. I had a lot of fun.
All right.
Got to see other parts of the world, so it was good.
Where all did you travel to?
I was in Germany, so that was a nice...
We lived in Schwäbisch Hall for 3 years. That's where we
were. So I was in Bad Kreuznach, which is southeast of Frankfurt, probably about 90 minutes.
I got you. All right. So you had your fill of schnitzel, I'm sure.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I still love that stuff. Can't get it here like that at all.
No, sir. No, sir.
All right. So you were there, then you came back and you went straight into police or not?
Yes, I put my application into Miami-Dade, and I put my application into Florida Highway Patrol.
Nice. And you got picked up with Miami-Dade then?
No, I got picked up first by Highway Patrol, but when I went down to continue in the process there, they told me what the starting salary was, and I said, I can't do that. So
I mean, I got to eat.
Right. $13,500.
Now, what year was that?
That was 1988, 89.
13,500,
88, 89. Good
Lord.
And Miami-Dade was about 30.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
So it was not even, you can't, and their big selling point was that they had a take home car. But I said, take-home car doesn't offset that much difference.
I tell you what I'm wondering, and I've been wondering this for a while. I'm the guy that I'm constantly reflecting on who I am, who I've been, where things are going, things like that. And one of the questions that I've had, and I kind of know the answer, at least with me, I kind of know the answer. But I'm wondering what causes someone like me to engage in crime and someone like you to go on the good guy side and engage in public service. Let's be honest. You could have gotten a degree making umpteen dollars, but you chose a field of public service, of serving your fellow man, doing the right damn thing every single day. I did not. It took me a long time to come to that. And I'm wondering do you have any ideas about what separates the two? What causes one person to go into one and one not?
If I had that answer, I think that I'd be more than, making more than the teams there. I would, that's a magic bullet, if you will. I've wondered about that kind of thing many, many times, because I have seen, many a cop kid that walked the wrong path, and know the parents personally and know that they're, good. I know that they did everything that they could do to try to make sure the kid did the right thing, made the right choices, all that kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of different factors that are involved there. And I think some of them may even be, personality and things that are hard coded in us, if you will. Right. And some of those things are just, and how strong that they are within that person, because, some of them might be able to, you might be able to rehabilitate somebody. But there's folks as well as I that can't be rehabilitated.
No, I mean, I was, to be fair with you, it took me several attempts. I mean, I was given opportunity after opportunity after opportunity, and it finally caught on. But I've seen people that it doesn't matter how many attempts you give them, how much you want to, try to get them on the straight path or anything else, it's just not going to work out like that.
100%.
And that's something I've been worried. I've been thinking about that a lot, George. I mean, I really have. My sister, she had the same upbringing that I did. She engages in shoplifting at a very early age. But other than that, she's a teacher, a good citizen, good parent. She's got anger issues, but, nothing illegal for the woman. Me, I mean, I was not that kid. I was a kid that grew up hands-on with it. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, what separated the two of us. And I think I know. I mean, at one point I did a podcast with Denise, and she said that she always thought that someone was going to come and save us. And I told her I knew that no one ever would. And I think that's what really caused, looking back at my life, I think that's what caused that divergence of paths at that point. And of course, you know, when I became an adult, I was already well-versed, and I just chose that field of crime. But it nags at me. Like you said, you've seen children of law enforcement, good people, that went down that bad path. And it can't be all just upbringing. It can't be all biology. I mean, there's got to be something else that is causing that switch to get thrown like that. I just can't ping it. And I keep trying to figure it out, you know?
That's a tough one for sure. You know, I mean, like I said, I've thought about that, you know, quite a bit. I mean, I haven't been able to figure that one out either.
So I did a podcast a few weeks ago, a psychology podcast. And the whole show was about, you know, what kind of stress did I go through when I was a criminal? And let me tell you, it was high. And I'm wondering how stressful a job in law enforcement is.
Well, it can be pretty stressful at some times. I mean, I think that, you know, law enforcement creates a lot of its own stressors.
Right.
I think we, you know, all jobs do. You know, we have our own internal stressors that we, you know, put on ourselves, our bosses. I think that, you know, government as a whole has a lot of bureaucracy, which adds another layer in there as well. I think that, well, you know, the obvious thing is that the job that we do, the only thing that's the same every single day is taking that key out, putting it in the ignition of that car and turning it. At that point in time, anything could and possibly will happen.
Right.
Fortunately, for the most part, I can say that the times of any type of substantial conflict are far and few between. But those, when those happen, that's the epitome of stress, right. You know. But day to day, I can say that, you know, law enforcement is a pretty stressful, you know, at some point in time during any given day, you're going to be stressed, at work for something's going to happen. And when I say that, I'm not saying, oh, your boss is going to get on you because you forgot some paperwork or you missed court or something. I'm talking about a call that you're dealing with, some kind of an incident or event or something is going to happen, and it's going to cause stress for you. I mean, it is not an unknown that, you know, law enforcement has, as a rule, super high divorce rate, probably the number one. It has super high cardiac related deaths and cardiac related issues. So, you know, those kinds, to the point where, you know, they have, you know, we have heart bills and things like that to try to help us, you know, right. Deal with, you know, the all of those types of things. So the stressors in law enforcement are many. And even, you know, even at my level, you know, they're still, you know, they're still there. I'm dealing with problems differently, you know, even problems on the road or problems, you know, that my folks, you know, during an investigation or something are getting involved with, but nonetheless, I'm looking at them more globally and having to marshal multiple resources to respond to an issue or event. So my type of stress is more, brought on by myself trying to manage and resolve something safely, quickly, you know, with minimum, you know, bad stuff happening, you know, all that kind of thing. I'm not on the street anymore, fortunately, that I've got to make snap decisions and deal with that kind of thing.
Let me ask, why do you think the divorce rate is so high?
Well, I think that as a rule, cops are, you know, law enforcement as a rule are a lot of them are narcissists. I think that they
a lot of bad guys are too.
Well, I agree. Yeah. I agree. They, you know, so that, you know, is not a good thing for, you know, for relationships. I think that, you know, we have to, depending upon our job, sometimes we have to pretend to be bad guys and do undercover work and that kind of thing. And
right.
Can't provide information necessarily to the spouse that the spouse might want to know. We have problems with having to up and leave, you know, at different times. I mean,
right.
You get called out in the middle of the night, you get called out on Christmas and have to leave. I mean, I can't tell you how many times over the years that I've had those kinds of situations, sitting down for Thanksgiving dinner and then I got to go. The all of those factors, I think, contribute to, you know, to that kind of.
And the reason I ask you that, because on the criminal side, obviously it's, you know, the divorce rate is high for criminals too. If the criminal marries somebody that is, you know, not a criminal.
Sure.
And with me, you know, it was putting criminal activity in front of the relationship. You know, that came first. Sure. That was my addiction. That was the most important thing to me. And I chose that every day over top of a relationship. And I was wondering if, you know, if law enforcement was much similar to that. You know, I'm a cop. That's what I do. I'm going out doing good, protecting people. And that becomes your thing after a while.
It is. It's your identity. I mean, that's the reality. Military is the same way. I mean, and they have the same kind of things and issues and whatnot, you know, where they get deployed, you know, that kind of thing. So, I think that, you know, any kind of a occupation that's that way is always going to become problematic for relationships.
Well, you've been on the good guy side of cyber about as long as I was on the bad guy side of cyber. That's really interesting. And, I would ask, I definitely want to talk about this for a while, but so Telegram, mm-hmm. What do you think about Telegram these days?
Well, I think Telegram has become the favored methodology for cyber criminals in general to do everything or to do a lot of the things that they used to do on the dark web, to communicate with each other, you know, all that kind of stuff. They've set up groups there. I mean, you know the deal. They've set up different, you know, things so that they can advertise their services or what something they're selling, coordinating different types of activities, bringing together like-minded folks to do stuff.
I was, it's interesting. I'm on Telegram about every day and I'm there under Brett Johnson. So, you know, a lot of people know who I am and most of the channels are okay with it. They figure, hey, at least we know he's here and still here under some, you know, assumed name. But, one of the channels that got shot over to me 2 days ago was a channel that sells skimmers. And I'm going to make a short video of it and put it out next couple of days on social media. But, it really got me how well refined some of these channels have become. For example, when I ran Shadow Crew, we had people who sold skimmers, and those skimmers ran about $5,000 is what they ran. Then you'd have to, you know, you'd get a camera, a keypad overlay, what have you, and you'd set it up and go from there. But you know, back then, we didn't have the, I guess you'd say, the marketing expertise that these guys have today. For example, the channels that I was seeing, they show exactly how the skimmer is installed, the ease of which it's installed, how they're shipping the product to you, how they, you know, they stealth ship it to you, how to install the damn thing. They show the different types of skimmers they've got. And that entire channel is just an advertisement for their skimmers. They do gasoline skimmers and they do ATM skimmers. And I've got to tell you, it's one of the most impressive things that I've seen. They sell these damn things for $2,500 a pop. And, you know, the camera is, you know, $400 or $500, which includes a really nice setup where you can't even see the cameras in there, or the keypad overlays there as well. If you can't afford the $2,500, that's okay. They've got a partnership where you pay them $1,000. They send you the equipment. Everything's encrypted. You send them the files. They decrypt it and give you half of the dumps that they're capturing from there. And that's, I guess that's one of the big things I've noticed with Telegram, and not only Telegram, but cybercrime as a whole, is that that evolution from where I started. And as a criminal, we had to know really every single aspect of every single thing that we were doing. We had to know what the security of the companies were. We had to know how to run drop addresses. We had to know how to launder out money. We had to know this, all the way down the line. And these days, it's not like that. These days, it's off-the-shelf products, tools, services. You've got tutorials. You've got classes that you can take. You've got people that will walk you through it, that will partner with you to teach you how to do it and profit with you at the same time. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, you know, like you said, it's an evolutionary process. I think that, you know, back in the old days, you know, there was not that, the cybercrime, if you will, was not what it is today. The ability for communication and you know, encrypted communication where they feel safe, right, where they can talk about these things, certainly didn't, you know, wasn't there, you know. So you didn't really have the ability for them to proliferate the way that they can today. I mean, now today you have you know, the ability in an instant to be, you know, broadcasting even your show here global, right, you know. And it's the same thing there. They're able to market now globally, you know, and like you said, they've refined their capabilities, you know, and they package themselves as a specialist in whatever X. I'm specialist in creating a skimmer, you know.
Right.
And then he gets with one of his friends who's a marketing guy, and they create a video. And then next thing you know, you've got this really slick looking video that gives you this whole complete tutorial and the whole deal. And then the other, you know, the marketing or some other guy says, you know what, I'll finance this if these people are just starting out,
right,
if I get half of the revenue stream. I mean, these are not, they're not inventing anything. They're right, looking at what does AT&T do when they give you a new iPhone? They do the same exact thing. So they're just looking at what is done in the non-criminal world, and they're creating the application within the criminal environment.
So where does it stop? I mean, we've seen that evolution to where now you, mm-hmm, don't have to be a sophisticated criminal or even understand the dynamics of the crime. We've seen that. We're at the point where we have cybercrime or fraud as a service. Certainly we're not through growing. Things are not through evolving. So where the hell does this end up at?
I don't think it ever ends. I just think this is a, you know, crime has been around since mankind began. You know, I mean, there was, people were stealing, people were fighting, people were, you know, doing things that were that they weren't supposed to be doing.
Right.
And this is just the next evolutionary step in that. You know, we are becoming more and more digital, more and more cyber enabled, if you will, and as such, what I would call more classical or traditional types of crimes are merging into this area and merging with those cyber enabled or cyber capabilities, and I think that's where things are going to continue to go.
No, I would not disagree. I would not. You know, I was reading on the, and I made a few posts about it, the MGM attack. Mm-hmm. I hesitate to call it an attack. I certainly don't want to call it a hack when it involved LinkedIn and a phone call. But, you know, it goes into this idea that 90% plus of every single attack uses known exploits. It's not the stuff that we don't know about. It's the stuff that we do know about. Typically the shit we've been told about for years that we're not doing anything about that creates that threat landscape. And, mm-hmm, you've been doing this stuff a while. Do you think, what does it take? I don't even want to ask you if you think that. What does it take to convince organizations and individuals to enact those proper security measures that people have been preaching about for decades?
Well, I think that it takes accountability. You know, so far, I mean, even, let's just, you know, go back to 2008 when we had the recession and that whole reset with the banks, right, and all that kind of stuff. Not too many of those folks were even held accountable for the shenanigans that went on that caused that situation. You know, we don't really hold high up folks accountable. You know, it just seems to be, you know, something that we do. I mean, look at everything that's even going on, you know, at the executive level of, in the United States government currently, you know. So that shouldn't be too surprising, okay? And because of that reason, those executives in those companies and in even in governmental agencies are, you know, they seem to be getting a pass on a lot of this stuff that is occurring on their watch.
Right.
And, you know, they're the ones that are saying, no, well, you know, I'm not going to make that kind of expenditure, and prioritizing, things within the organizational structure, that may not be, you know, in the best interest overall for that, for the cyber health of the company. And a lot of the stuff, like you said, is stuff that's out there, that's known, that's very easily remedied. Even something, I mean, we both are familiar with that situation there with the MGM, and right, and the reality of that is that probably would have been alleviated with appropriate training or, right, retraining, you know, right, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I was at a cyber exercise today, and it's actually still ongoing.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that we were discussing, one of the questions that came up was, how often are your folks trained? How often are your folks trained?
And what was
so,
the answer?
Well, we train annually. So okay, my folks get annually. Now there's some that are getting, you know, even more often than that, which was surprising to me. You know, I was talking with some of the some of our federal partners, and they get once a month.
Okay,
they're getting it. So, you know, those people are more, you know, the more training that you have, the less likely you are to fall victim to this kind of stupidity that would result in that kind of thing. So the bottom line, and just for the, you know, I certainly, you know, I don't make those kinds of decisions as far as frequency of training and that kind of stuff, but the bottom line is that until it becomes a priority for the decision makers, and I think that has to come from, you know, through accountability, you're going to just see the same kinds of things. You're going to see, you know, drips and drabs, and some folks that have a little bit better resources, like the federal government, like maybe a large, you know, organization or governmental agency that have those resources and capabilities to provide, you know, that level. Those are going to be the ones that are going to be maybe a little bit less likely to get taken advantage of versus some of these others.
So, and you were talking about accountability, and this is another one of these things that I ponder a lot. And I'll grant you, hey, if you look at the government, I don't really care which political wing you look at. We're not getting much, you know, modeling, positive modeling that we should be following. You know, we're getting arguments, we're getting the fringe that's coming in, infecting both wings, everything else. And it would seem, I mean, ideally, we have a government that is there that shows the right way to do things, and it trickles down. All right. But we don't have that. So if it's not trickling down, that positive, basically, role model, where do we get that? I mean, I'm at a situation right now. I was talking to Paul Eklof, and we mentioned that pre-recording, that, you know, a lot of the time these days, a lot of this fraud that's going on is kind of accepted by a lot of society. You know, they look at pandemic, they look at the unemployment fraud that took place, and they're like, you know, hey, yeah, get yours. And they don't realize that, hey, you can say that, but the victims at the end of the day are you, because you've got to repay all of those stolen losses. The government's not repaying that. They're just going to raise taxes, and you're going to repay that at the end of the day. So how do we get that type of role model, or that psyche shift that comes in and says, hey, this is wrong? Not only that, but it's not terribly difficult to mitigate a lot of the fraud and the crime that's out there if we just do what we need to do, instead of, you know, having apathy, not caring, passing the buck on to somebody else, and what have you.
Well, I think that, there's already strides being made in this area. You know, I mentioned today that I was, you know, earlier that I was involved in this training exercise. Yes. And the training exercise was put on by, other governmental agencies. And those other governmental agencies were are constantly out there evangelizing the need for security, and they're trying to facilitate the use of different tools, and providing those tools for companies and or governmental agencies that may not have the resources to be able to do these kinds of things. So I think that there's a recognition of that particular thing. And I can tell you that, you know, I am pretty heavily involved in doing that, you know, in the public safety space.
Okay.
And I can tell you that, many of the people that I encounter in the public safety space, you know, their biggest thing is they don't have the resources and the things that they need to be able to do some of this stuff. I mean, you know, I'm talking about, you know, there's a police department with, you know, three guys, you know, a chief of police and two officers, and they're running their stuff off of, you know, their personal cell phone on AT&T, you know.
Right.
So you know, how do you tell that guy who's doing everything that he can just to get by and provide a basic service to the folks that he lives, you know, his community, that he needs to be better with cybersecurity because, he's got to protect the data and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So there's not a, you know, that's a nut that needs to be cracked, you know, as far as that goes. And I don't, you know, I mean, I have my own thoughts as far as that goes, but until, you know, something happens, I don't see a whole lot of headway being made in that particular area or in that particular space. But there are people, I will say, there are people that are aware, and they do have conversations, because I'm involved in a lot of those conversations about this particular, you know, situation.
Yes.
Now, it's a whole other animal when you have somebody like MGM or these larger organizations that do have the resources and that just did not do what they were supposed to do.
Right.
That's a completely, completely different animal. And, you know, my personal opinion is that there should be accountability within that organizational structure. I mean, if you're telling me the one man band, you know, he had his data taken or something. Well, you know, I get it. You know what I'm saying? But somebody like, one of these people here, come on.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, I truly do. When I was breaking the law, I really did not give a damn about my victims. All right. Didn't care. That bothers me to say it, but that's just the bald-faced truth right there. I didn't care about my victims. And today I'm very fortunate that that I get to talk and consult to a lot of victims. And I imagine that you encounter a great deal of victims from these internet crimes as well, yes?
Of course.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit? Because here's my thing. I'm a firm believer, and I've talked about this before. I'm a firm believer that it is never the victim's fault that crime is perpetrated upon them. It's always the criminal's fault. It's an act of choice on the criminal's part each step of the way. I mean, I truly believe that. I've had some arguments about that because, you know, people point out, well, what about if they use the same password? And my thing is, you know, I don't really give a damn if they use the same password. It's still the choice of the criminal to act on that information. And I just like to get your feedback on some of that and maybe talk about some of these victims that you've dealt with, because, you know, I've talked to people that I talked to one guy, his name's Randy. I won't say his last name, but his mom lost her house to this romance scheme, and she was just on Social Security, lost her entire house to this romance scheme. I talked to another lady that ended up sending $1.1 million to a fraudster. She got to the point that she was completely broke. She borrows $200K from her dad to send to this fraudster. So, and it's not just these high dollar things. It's not. I'm friends with Eric Hunley. He's talked about it on his show now, so I can say that. But Eric Hunley gets ripped off for $2,000, $2,000 on a crypto scheme. And he reached out to me, and I thought, hey, yeah, we can, because he knew where the money was. It was in a Coinbase account. And he reached out to me, and I was like, well, yeah, man, I know all kinds of people that can help. And the truth of the matter was that he was not important enough. The dollar amount was not high enough for anybody to really look at it. And, you know, if you could just talk about some of these victims for a minute and give your opinion on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, you know, going back to the times, you know, you were talking about when you were victimizing people and that kind of stuff. And, you know, back in those times, for the most part, you know, people that were involved with these kinds of frauds and this cyber fraud, or, you know, it was a lot of that stuff was, you know, what had been classified as white collar stuff, you know, because, you know, the reality of the situation at the time was that who were the victims? The victims are the banks. The banks are going to write off the monies, you know. Is it impactful to society? I mean, you know, that's where things get, you know, gray, questionable. You know, I also know that, you know, you were involved in some identity thefts and that kind of stuff. And again, that's to facilitate, you know, credit card, you know, fraud. Yeah, it's a pain in the ass for the victim.
I got to be honest with you, George. I was a complete asshole. I mean, I would hit banks, I would hit corporations, but I'd hit people too, man. I mean,
I'm not minimizing, you know, the things that you did. I don't want you to take what I'm saying the wrong way. I'm just talking about the evolution of what we got going on today. Okay. So that was the precursor stuff. And you were involved in that stuff, you know, at that time.
Right.
You know, again, we were talking about how this crime has matured and evolved. Now it is much more personal to the individual now. And like I said before, the people that were taking the losses were the banks for the most part. Today, that's not the case. Today, now, you know, they're going after the individuals, and they're doing it, like you said, you know, the romance scam is a big one. Another big one is the stuff with the, you know, the grandparents, where they think that the grandkid has been abducted or something is going on, and they need so much money. There are as I'm sure that you know, I'm not telling you stuff that you don't know. I mean, this is a money making enterprise for some state actors. You know, this is as well as just a state sanctioned, if you will, business in some places, where you'll have, you know, folks that will go to work in a office building, just like, you know, I come to work in my office building. And instead of sitting down at their desk and doing something what we would classify as productive, they're, you know, luring, you know, little old ladies and other folks with, you know, all these different kinds of scams, investment scams, you know, all figuring out all these different things, how to get people to give them willingly, because that's the big thing. They're willingly giving them their life savings and their monies. That's the thing, because, you know, because they are willingly going to these financial institutions and withdrawing that money or sending that money to these guys, there is no recourse. There is no ability for them to say, oh, the bank, you know, it's like, you know, it's not a credit card. You know, they're dealing in cash, and they're the ones that are initiating the thing. And that's the big difference and the big change that we've seen. And the other aspect of that is they're not using, you know, like a wire transfer or what I would classify as a more fiat banking type of transaction. They're now taking that and being instructed to transfer that money into cryptocurrency and then, you know, send that cryptocurrency to wherever these people are or whatever they're doing and that kind of thing. And that it makes it, you know, that much more difficult to, you know, to obtain any information and ultimately recover, you know, assets for the victims. So you said something else, though, which resonated with me as well, was the fact that your friend had $2,000 taken from, you know, two things with that. You know, $2,000 maybe, you know, to most people, you know, it's not a tremendous amount of money. I mean, it's a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but it's not a tremendous amount of money. But you get to, you know, grandma who's on Social Security, $2,000 can be half a year's, you know, discretionary funds, right, or, you know, so it can be that much more. And what my point is $2,000 to her might be what, you know, $20,000 is to somebody else, or $2 million. You know what I'm saying? Right. You know, so just because it's not $2 million doesn't mean that they should not receive services, you know. So that was again another one of the reasons that we kind of got into this game, because the feds, you know, in all honesty, are completely overwhelmed, you know, and it's not their fault. It's just that the way that the laws are written is that you know, it's the feds are the ones that have to deal with stuff that's interstate or international types of crimes. So that was why we created what we created here with us. You know, everybody in my unit here is all, in my bureau, I should say, is all, are we're all dual sworn. So we have the ability to, you know, enforce obviously state, local, Florida statutes, but we can also enforce federal statutes, because we're sworn, you know, federal officers as well.
I mean, that's a damn nice thing to have right there.
Of course, because, you know, more often than not, as you know, these things traverse state lines and certainly, you know, international boundaries as well, especially with the larger organizations. Yeah. So we are, you know, we're able to provide that force multiplier, bring all the folks that are here and able to conduct these investigations, where, like I said, the feds don't have that capability as far as manpower is concerned. And now we can do those investigations and we can try to assist in the recovery of these assets for these folks.
Are you finding that you talked about manpower, ability, things like that? A lot of private industry has stepped up their game as far as using analytics to track some of these crimes that's going on. And I'm thinking about those people, those companies that track, say, the Bitcoin blockchain to see where the currency goes. Are you finding that a lot of these private companies are more helpful with law enforcement as far as handing over some of the data that might be needed to further these prosecutions or not?
Quite honestly, they're not. More often than not, they're not. They're, you know, the information that they're giving is stale. In this kind of game, especially once money has been converted into a cryptocurrency asset, time is absolutely of the essence.
Right.
Because there's very few cryptocurrency providers or exchanges that are helpful to law enforcement. You know, cryptocurrency, and this is my opinion, you know, was created for crime and to facilitate, you know, criminal activity.
I mean, I agree with that 100%.
Just the nature of it and the way the transactions are, and you know, it's a very, very complicated and difficult process to try and track these transactions, and you have to be very, very skilled and very, very highly trained in order to be successful in doing these things. And then, you know, not to fault the federal government, but, you know, they have to say, you know, this is the bar, because there's so many people that are victimized here. We can't do an investigation for less than 10 million, 25 million. You know, these are the numbers that are bandied about, you know, as far as getting the attention of somebody like, you know, the feds. You know, obviously our threshold is, you know, way lower. You know, we will get involved with and we'll assist with. I mean, we'll assist with $2,000 if we have one of our constituents come forward and say, hey, we were victimized here. You know, we're gonna get on it and we're gonna see how we can help. I have, you know, had folks reach out to us from all over the country because they know, you know, they hear in a talk or something that I've done that, you know, we have jurisdiction, you know, we can do the federal thing, you know. And they ask for help because their local agency has no knowledge or capability, or, you know, they've gone to the feds and the feds are not responsive and, you know, this kind of thing. And, you know, I can't help the entire United States. You know what I'm saying? So I have to, you know, in some cases, you know, tell them, I'm sorry, or we have to find a nexus to, you know, Florida or here in Miami-Dade County. And then if we can do something like that, then I'll, you know, have my folks take a look at it. But, sure, you know, sure. It's sad, but it's, you know, it's the reality because there's so much stuff going on.
You know, it's, you know, you had alluded to some of those state actors. And just so the audience knows, I mean, North Korea finances up to a third of their nuclear program through cybercrime. If cybercrime were a country today, it would have the third largest economy on the planet. And this is what law enforcement deals with every day. Not only nation state actors, but millions of cyber criminals across the planet, across jurisdictions, in countries that sometimes are not very friendly with United States law enforcement. That's what we have to deal with. And it becomes very complicated. And I my hat's off to you. Truly, you have nothing but my respect for the job that you're doing over there. I think it's outstanding. I really do.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I did want to ask. I know we're running a little bit long. I wanted to ask two.
That's all right. Sure.
When we talked on the phone, and it blew my mind because I didn't realize it, but you talked about, you mentioned how some of these drug deals, you know, used to when you went and bought, like I referred to my dad in the 1980s, they had the tables of cash, but it's not like that now. Now you've got the drug trade going on, and they're simply handing over maybe a thumb drive or sending, you know, a Bitcoin wallet address or what have you like that. And that seems to me that that changes the game completely at that point.
Oh, 100%. I mean, we have not had a cash seizure of any significance in probably 10 years.
10 years.
You know, there was a migration from from cash over to gift cards and you know, what are those, the
prepaid
the Visa
gift,
you know, the Visa card. Right. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And they were sending bricks of those, you know, for instead of cash.
Right.
And that kind of, you know, was smart because it made things a little bit more difficult, and it was easier to transport and, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, very quickly we caught on that they were migrating to a new methodology.
Right.
And now it's migrated again to the cryptocurrency game, because I mean, think about a cash mule, you know, in the old days, they would strap literally with duct tape cash onto their bodies, you know, and then they would get onto an airplane and they would travel to wherever they were going. And then they would, you know, on the other end, they would be met by the handler and then they would remove the cash. And that was that. You know, now and there's a limit to what one individual could transport, you know, and a lot of times they'd get flagged at an airport or something, and then they would lose that cash. Now all they got to do is, you know, just grab a thumb drive, like you said, and you could put however many millions of dollars you want on that thing. And you know, they get on the airplane, even if you even need to, you know.
Right.
But if you want to send it, you know, over the over the network, you know, then you're introducing some methodology of somebody is looking at or monitoring, you know, maybe large transactions, you know, that might raise an eyebrow, you know, because there are you know, capabilities with respect to that kind of stuff. But
right. But
you could put however much you want on a thumb drive, stick it in your pocket, get on an airplane, and or even put it in a FedEx,
right,
and send it to wherever you wanted it to go, and no one's going to bat an eyeball at that. And and then that person has that, you know, stuff, and they can just plug it in and they can start to use that cash, you know, put that cash into an exchange and start to draw off of that wallet.
Right.
So there's been a significant shift and change into the ways and methodologies that these folks are dealing with payments and transference of cash.
And I thank you for answering that, because I absolutely think that's, I mean, that's some shit right there. Excuse my language. I mean, that's from a criminal point of view, that's really doing things. I mean, it really is. You save time, effort, money. You're far safer at the end of the day. I mean, it's just, it is an outstanding way to do things from a criminal point of view.
Sure.
When I was running Shadow Group, the Ukrainians that I dealt with, the English speakers that I dealt with, people in the Europe and things like that, we were typically, you know, we were just geeks, criminal geeks, but we were geeks. It wasn't until the last days of Shadow Crew that we started to see violence coming into that type of environment. And I'm wondering, I have a theory, it's just a theory, that violence has increased over the years because you've got different demographics of people that are coming in. The drug trade is kind of intertwined with fraud in a lot of these marketplaces and things like that. And I'm wondering, from the law enforcement side, have you seen that increase in violence? Is that just some sort of wonky theory that I've got, or is that something that's actually happening?
No, it's, you know, as I've said, traditional types of crimes are becoming more intertwined within the cyber realm. So, you know, the drug trafficking trade, though it still exists and will always exist, you know, they're cyber enabling a lot of stuff, even with the monies and that kind of thing. So they're always going to be, you know, very, very violent, you know, if you will. But some of the things that we have noticed is where you have some of these, you know, street level gangs that in the past, you know, they were kind of relegated to, you know, street level narcotics dealing, you know, prostitution, normal, what I would say, normal classical type of street crimes, and, you know, violence. You know, there was a lot of violence in those groups. And they're now recognizing how easy and it is to get into, you know, the cyber crime, cyber fraud, PPP fraud, you know, these kinds of things, and how lucrative it is, and how easy it is, and how safe it is. It's safe on a lot of different levels. If you get arrested and charged, you know, for that kind of a crime, you're looking at, again, white collar stuff. So you're not looking at a whole, you know, person's crime, significant time. And secondly, you know, when you're dealing with that type of stuff, your personal exposure is not as great either to law enforcement, because they, you know, for the most part, don't really know what they're doing. You know, they don't know what they don't know. And secondly, you know, the bad guys that you're dealing with are not the same caliber of bad guy that you were associating with before. So that your likelihood of getting shot or something like that has diminished. Now, what I can say is as that has proliferated, you're starting to have turf wars and things within these different gangs. And, you know, like maybe gang A, you know, has their territory over here, and gang B is over here, and gang A put some skimmers into gang B's area. Well, that's a problem. You know, it's almost like you have a dealer, you know, and the dealer comes over into your territory, you know, you're going to retaliate and you're going to deal with that. Right. So some of those kinds of things are also starting to happen. So yes, I think that, you know, you have two kinds of things that are working in that same space.
Yes, sir. And final question, we're going to close things out. Final question. I asked Andrew Hayden this a few weeks ago. I'm going to ask you the same thing. How does AI affect or how do criminals benefit from AI? And how are they going to benefit from it?
Well, you know, specifically, my thoughts on this particular thing. I have spoken all over the world on this particular topic. You know, we have seen some instances where, you know, bad guys have gotten involved with creation of some types of deep fakes and used those deep fakes for extortion. You know, fortunately, it was when the technology was much more, it had not evolved to the degree that it is now. Right. So it was relatively simple for us to be able to debunk it. Now it's much, much better, which is, of course, makes it that much more difficult for us to do so. But we are staying on top of all the methods and means to do that. But again, I see this area as a pivot for bad guys, because this is going to be a facilitator, in my opinion, and it's going to make it a force multiplier for them as well, for bad guys.
Right.
Because now you can, just as we all have seen with these different generative AI models, you know, you can ask it to write you an essay, you know, or ask you to write you a proposal for this, or to do whatever it is that you need it to do in furtherance of your business or your occupation, you know. And people are using it all the time. We see in medicine. You know, they're using it to identify cancers and different things that they weren't able to before, because it's able to go into massive amounts of data and make associations and identify patterns and different things that it could not, you know, human being could not do. So all we got to do is step back at it and say, okay, let's put our bad guy hat on and say, how is it that this stuff could facilitate, you know, a bad actor? And, you know, it's not a stretch. We've already started to see some instances where some of these emails that are being used for phishing and that kind of stuff very clearly are being constructed a lot more carefully, and they're more, I don't want to say professional, you know, which is like what you would expect from a CEO or from somebody within a you know, high up within a company, with instructions that are not you know, with misspellings or cryptic or, you know, three letter words and, you know, this kind of stuff, give, you know, which is what we've seen in the past, and people still fell for those, you know?
Right.
So now, you know, with this capability, like I said, we're starting to see this stuff. It makes it that much more credible and believable. And I just see this continuing, and to be more, as we've discussed this entire time, with the evolution of technology and the use of technology in criminal activities, I just see it's going to continue on that arc and that trajectory, and it's going to get woven more into day-to-day criminal use.
I mean, I would absolutely agree. I truly would. George Parra, cybercrime investigator extraordinaire, Miami-Dade. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, sir. Anytime.
Any advice as we close things out? Any advice for companies or individuals out there before we go away for the day?
Well, the thing that I usually close with when I'm giving a talk is I tell people that, you know, you get these emails, you get these different kinds of stuff that come in, and if somebody's telling you to do something, double check it, you know, and double check it in a way that you know is valid, not in something that's inside of whatever that thing is. And when I'm saying that, I'm saying, let's say you got an email and the email says, you know, call me or email me back. No, you're calling that person off of your phone on a phone number that you know is a trusted phone number for that individual to validate that instruction that person's doing. If we start doing that kind of thing, that's going to cut down on quite a bit of stuff.
All right, so that was episode 90 of The Brett Johnson Show. If you like it, take a second, hit that subscribe button. That's right, just press that little subscribe button. If you don't like it, press it twice. That way, you know, you can hear more stuff that you don't like. You maybe want to bitch to me about it in the comment section. Or shoot me an email if you can find the email. Shoot me an email. Let me know what you like about the show. Let me know what you don't like about the show. If you got any guests that you would like me to bring on, just shoot it over. Leave it in the comments section. I read all the comments. I respond to most of the comments, unless you're an ass. And then I'll probably respond to those as well. I'm Brett Johnson. We're going to close out the show. How do we close it out? We close it out the exact same way every single day. Stay safe out there. Stay secure. Stay vigilant. More importantly, understand that this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, at the end of the day, at the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.